Now it says here, in terms of the cows, very beautiful picture. After good rains, this is 5,000 years ago, the grazing ground for the animals was full of green pasture, and both the bulls and the cows sat down on the grass fully satisfied. The cows, followed by their calves, appeared tired of grazing because of full milk bags. Calmly and quietly, the cows and calves rested and ruminated, chewing their cud. How many stomachs does a cow have?
Four.
Four, yeah. And one of them is not really, actually a storage sack. In the morning when the grass is fresh and cool, they harvest it. They chew enough to put it in their little storage place in there. You see them later in the day when they sit down under the trees and some shade, okay, they just start like that, pushing it back up. They chew on it and all their juice comes out and then, you know, it goes on like that, you know, so on. It's a very incredible machine. A cow is an incredible machine. Then Prabhupada says, protection and grazing ground for the cows are among the essential needs for society. Yeah. It's interesting because over here you can't build anything, right? It might turn into a good pasture land for cows, right? Yeah? Might get the property and have nice grazing ground for some cows and stuff. Be careful of getting stuck in the water, but maybe Krishna has a plan like that. So many times we've seen that the properties that devotees get for temples, it was already planned. And Krishna already knew where he was going to be everything else. And devotees were kind of like, yeah, I want a temple here. I want a little few cows in front of my temple. Like that. Okay. Pasturing, protection for the cows, and grazing grounds are essential needs for society and the welfare of people in general. The animal fat required for the human body can be well derived from cow's milk. Okay? Cow's milk is very important for human energy, and the economic development of society depends on sufficient food grains, sufficient milk, and sufficient transportation. My God. Transportation and distribution of these products. Okay, what is it? Sufficient milk, sufficient grains, and transportation and distribution. Lord Sri Krishna, by his personal example, taught us the importance of cow protection, which is meant not only for the Indian climate, but for all human beings all over the universe. Yeah. Less intelligent people underestimate the value of cow's milk. Cow's milk is also called goras, or the juice from the body of the cow. Milk is the most valuable form of goras, and from milk, we can prepare many important and valuable foodstuffs for the upkeep of the human body. The killing of cows by human society is one of the grossest suicidal policies. Wow, okay. The killing of cows by human society is one of the grossest suicidal policies. And those who are anxious to cultivate the human spirit must turn their attention first toward the question of cow protection. God. Keep cow protection, keep dogs. Yeah. Yeah. So, of course, one big thing is happening now is many devotees are also becoming vegan. Vegan. Right? And, of course, the term is also kind of a general term in some ways, but it means usually no milk products. What else? No dairy products. Like that, basically like that. And so people say, well, you know, what's the... There are many different aspects of it. Because one aspect is the milk we get a lot of times from these dairies is actually very contaminated, like that. Baskin-Robbins ice cream, is that here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, in America it was a gigantic chain like that. The guy was, you know, one of the king of like ice cream chains. So his son grew up in this whole environment. And there's, in the backyard they had a swimming pool shaped like an ice cream cone. So he was supposed to take over the whole empire, everything else. But then he began to discover where the milk was coming from, just a little bit. And after that he started, this is not nice, this is terrible, you know. So he began to investigate more, and he said actually he wanted just to give it up, because it was so like horrifying. But he went ahead because of courage and everything else. And finally he wrote a book called, what's it called, Diet for a New America? It's called Diet for a New America, John Robbins. And it was so incredible, you know, that all the other books on vegetarianism and animal rights, almost kind of like this, you know, pay their obeisances and like that. You see, everything was so complete, you know. He took his father's, you know, very complete, qualified nature and turned it against his father in some ways. So he went through this whole thing. It was a wonderful book, very good, but I think still it's like, you know, hard to beat. He went through the ethical and moral dimension, you know, of animal slaughter in the dairy industry. He went through the health aspect of meat eating and dairy. He went through the fact that animals are people, like that. The economics, everything, very systematically. You know. And so many things like that. For example, there's just even more studies now that meat eating is so systematically related to different diseases like that, especially breast cancer. It's just like you have 40% more chance of getting breast cancer or something if you're eating meat and not. It's just one after another like that, the health factors like that. So practically speaking, it's pretty easy to substantiate that meat is not a good diet, you know, for human beings like that. Then in terms of animals, well, animals are just, you know, just meat. They don't have a soul, right? Only human beings have souls, like that, and so on. So he gives so many stories of the history of animals and how they're, you know, how they're people. You know? One, for example, there was one lady. She was in her her boat. Yes, with several people, went across the Pacific Ocean, one sailboat, and she fell off like that. And the boat goes away with her screaming at night. Nobody noticed it, so she's floating in the water, and I'm going to drown. And she's kind of swimming and hanging on there, and then suddenly something's pushing her up. And what is it? It was a big sea turtle, like this big. And she was, of course, terrified. Ah! But, you know, the guy didn't grab her and eat her, and what are you going to do? You know, so she kind of like stayed in the back of the sea turtle. She just was traveling. And the sea turtle swam for something like about, you know, 6 hours, and finally came right to a light buoy. On a channel, because in the ocean there are these buoys where these, you know, they're floating with lights on top, and the ships follow these, they're traveling like that and so on. So it took her right there, and she got off of him and swam over and climbed up on the thing, and of course after some time when ship came by and found her, but it didn't go away, it kept on swimming around until actually some boat came like that, and then it went away like that. So this is a true story like that. Mm-hmm. And these guys never stay above the water for more than maybe 10 minutes, like that, and so on. You know. But other stories, turtles saving people. One veterinarian was in New York, and he got a good offer for a job in Los Angeles. Now, if you know New York and Los Angeles, how many miles is this? About 3,000 miles. You know. But it wasn't going to be very, very practical to take his dog, so he left his dog in New York. Okay. And he was there in Los Angeles for several months, working everything else. And one day he came home, you know, it was hot, everything else. And there was a dog on his porch. You know, and look at the dog, and it had, like, you know, briars and all this stuff. And it was obviously been outside for a long time and everything else. But it looked like his dog. You know, what is this? You know. So he opened the door. The dog ran inside and hopped up right on its favorite chair and sat there like that. You know, it's ridiculous. You know. So he knew his dog, he'd done some surgery on it, so he looked down there, the scar was right there. Okay. So somehow this dog had traveled 3,000 miles and found the guy. Okay. Cut him up, have him for dinner. Yeah. One more story. This is about Jack. You know Jack? Okay. So Jack was a dolphin. And his place is the one channel, like in north of England, where there's a lot of rocks and stuff like that. It's really kind of dangerous to go through, especially the tides are moving and stuff, and a lot of ships got damaged. But there were some porpoises. Porpoises that stay there. And one porpoise named Jack would lead these ships through like that, you know, so on. You know? So he'd come and he would hop out of the water, and then he would just follow him like that. You know? And if you know, usually they have to wait a little bit. He'd come and they had their boat, and they would stop and kind of just let their motors run, and he would show up, and he would just, you know, take them through like that and so on. So unbeknownst to the crew, one guy was just traveling as a passenger, and he thought he would shoot the dolphin like that. So he shot it with a gun. And the crew wanted to kill the guy and everything else like that, so on. And after that, there was no Jack, you know, to lead the boat through. So a couple ships, maybe two or three actually, you know, had crashed and everything else like that, and other problems like that. You know. But after some time, Jack showed up again, like that. It was a scar on his body, you know. And again, he was leading the ship through. But he would not lead the ship through where this guy had shot him. When it shot him, he could recognize him. He refused him. By your own fish. Like that. You know? So there's a whole section on this, that animals are people. And in some ways, it seems they're better, you know, more sophisticated than we are. They have abilities and natures and things that we don't have even like that. So we can't say we're on higher level on the food chain. Well, if you don't eat meat, you won't be strong, right? Yeah. Right, yeah. He goes through all these things. One of the guys is, what's his name? Something Davis. Scott Davis?
MMA.
Iron Man Triathlon. I think it's Scott Davis. Actually, he went to UC Davis, my school. You know. So they have these triathlons where you're going to swim, do bicycling and run. So it's three things. And they have competitions, you know. So they have them all over the world. And the heaviest one is in Hawaii. It's called the Iron Man Triathlon. Like that. So first you go, you swim in the Hawaiian Ocean. And sometimes the Hawaiian Ocean has like these, like, what, like, you know, 15-meter tall waves. You know? They don't go swimming in that part, but you know, they go swimming where it's like, you know, it's real. It isn't like swimming across your swimming pool. It's like, you know, you get a whole thing like that, you know. So first you got to swim maybe three miles of this water, you know. Then you get out, those guys that survive get out, they get on their bicycle, and got a 20-foot bicycle like 50 kilometers. And Hawaii is full of these volcanic craters, everything else, they're competing with that. Then finally the whole thing finishes off with something like, I guess, like, you know, a six-kilometer straight run. So it says that very few people can ever even do this. Okay. And like, nobody has won it more than one time except Scott Davis. In over 5 years, he won it like three times. Yeah, okay. So it says that some people think that Scott Davis is the fittest man who ever lived. Scott Davis is a vegetarian. Another guy he gives is this Marine Corps captain who's a vegetarian in the Marine Corps. And actually, the armed services has vegetarian arrangements like that, you know, so on. So this guy, you know, he holds a world's record on sit-ups. You lie on your back and you sit up like that. He has the world's, because you have to do it within 24 hours. He does something like, you know, 15,243 sit-ups like that in 24 hours, yeah. Another time, for the fun of it, he swam upriver in this heavy river, shot a basketball 4,000 times, all within a certain time like that, you know. So he's this Marine Corps captain. He's also a vegetarian, you know. So he goes through all these heavy athletes, everything else like that, the vegetarians. What else? The beef industry, the beef industry destroys the environment, you know. The excrement and everything else produced by these animals is unbelievable, you know, what it does to the environment and so on. And health, I got that before. Your body can't digest it properly. So his whole very, very complete book, very good book. It's easy to read too. A Diet for a New America. And his father was so angry with his kid because he became this whole, like, you know, thing about, because the milk, finally the milk, where does the milk come from? They show these pictures of these happy cows, you know, moo. And it's a big variety in the dairies, big variety. In California, some Christians have a dairy called Clover. And they treat the cows okay until they send them down the road, you know. Okay, you know. But before that, they treat them nicely and everything else. And their milk is much more better in terms of the amount of DDT that's in it, the amount of pus that's in it. You know, it's everything much more healthy, sane kind of milk. Other stuff, the milk is so contaminated it's actually poisonous, like that and stuff. You know, it's just living on milk. But some of the milk is so contaminated because the animals are so tortured. And the Prabhupada says that some of these things cannot even be mentioned in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada mentions a lot of stuff in the pages of the Bhagavatam, but he gets the point of some of these things. Some of the systems, the cows are kept in cages, which are lifted up mechanically and taken to the washing area, the milking area, the injecting area, and they never leave a cage their entire life. Natural lifespan is about 25 years, I think. These animals live maybe like about 16 years. It's just, when he saw this stuff, it was just like unbelievable. You know? And what kind of people do this work? People with warts across half their faces, people with like IQ of 14 or something, this really condemned people. and the killing area, they won't let anybody stay there. They pay them more, but they won't let them stay there for more than, I think, it's 2 weeks. Some people want to stay there to get paid more, but their experience is again and again, these guys just go crazy. They start getting knife fights with other guys and everything else. So it's a whole industry. You can talk about it like this. So some people become vegan. Okay, we won't participate. It's like Arjuna, right? I'm going to walk away from the battle. So even now, some of the devotees are doing this. Okay, to avoid this contaminated milk, okay. But you can find, some of it is better. And if you're living in the forest, just a rishi doing chanting every day, 24 hours of hearing and chanting and that kind of stuff, you don't need much psychic, energy, vitality like that. Your body can be very gentle like that. But if you're going to be a kind of pundit for the kings and going preaching and doing all activities, then you need psychological energy and stuff like that, strength. And for that we have to have milk. Milk is a natural form of this mental strength, energy for mental strength and stuff like that. So our point is, as you see this, that vegans many times are like, they haven't got this energy to go out and stand up against these people and stuff like that. And also the mental strength to be able to form ideas and arguments like that. Kshatriya argues like with his arms. Brahmana has to argue with his mind. You see, Subhag Maharaj, whenever he's going to argue with somebody, he puts his hand behind his back. As soon as he does that, he's ready to argue. So, but that's what a Brahmana does. He uses all his heavy psychological techniques. I got a black belt in karate, and you learn techniques, how to deal with certain situations like that. For example, what's one here? Pick one out. Okay. You're going to attack somebody. Okay, you've got a club this long, so you step forward. At the same time, you aim this knuckle, holding onto the club, at the person's earlobe. Okay. That shakes him up a little bit. Then you go right for the solar plexus, like that. Then you drop down and go right for the kneecap. So. Then if the guy is still standing, you turn around and you use your run fu. run fu? See, it's the most ancient and most effective form of self-defense. When I got the black belt, my instructor informed me about this. He said, if you get in a fight, you're going to get hurt. The guy who gets hurt the least is the winner. So if you can use run fu, use it. But you learn all these techniques. And when you're fighting, there's not time enough to think about it. Well, I think I'll do this, that, and this. It's built into your reflexes. You've got to practice every day and stuff like that. So same way, if you're going to be a Brahmin, you learn all these arguments and stuff like that. Verbal combat to establish the point like that and so on. Then beyond that, of course, a devotee is personal and so on. So Prabhupada said that. He said, I know verbal judo. I know their weakness and I beat on that until they die. So when to use it? When to use violence like that? When to use verbal violence and so on? But that's a Brahmana's job, learning these arguments and stuff. And as much as we can do that, it's a very good contribution to society to be able to establish things, to be able to protect cows. Prabhupada says the best way to protect the cows is by sankirtan. Spreading the sound vibration, the ideas, the knowledge like that. You give a good argument. I was doing all this preaching in the universities and wondering what's the use, and the book distribution not so high. But then I was in Chile, and we gave a whole lecture on Sankhya, what is the soul, everything else. And it was actually the next year, and then one devotee came and said, "Oh, Maharaj, I'm taking biology at the university." And it was one of our, we were talking about like evolution. And somebody brought up reincarnation and people were joking. And then the professor said, no. He said, actually, one of these Hare Krishnas was here last year. And he gave a whole explanation. I went out of curiosity. And now I can see how it's very practical, how the mind and getting involved and this and that. And he gave a very nice explanation then of how, reincarnation, the mechanism, can function like that. And the students were all listening. So you may give somebody a simple argument, some idea like that. That's why stories are nice. The scholar and the boatman, that one, or the bird in the cage. you know, these analogies, people, they can catch them and then they tell somebody else. You know? And we see it's actually the fact. All over the world now, our ideas have gone out in many places like that. You know? So cow protection, a very important topic. But practically speaking, until people are vegetarian and understand reincarnation, they can't understand anything else. You know? So you have to have lots of prasadam distribution, you know, and developing the idea of the consciousness. And vegan is okay if you're not going to be engaging in sankirtan preaching and work that requires mental strength. After lectures, I almost always have a headache. So this Ayurvedic doctor, a really good Ayurvedic doctor in Peru, he says, you get headaches after lectures. I said, well, yeah. He said, because the brain works on sugar. Right? So after that, drink some hot tea with a little sugar. So many ways to get sugar. If you chew a chapati and your mouth thoroughly, it produces sugar. Yeah? But yeah, brahmana is just headaches, everything else like that. And everybody has different nature. You know, somebody has worked with their shoulders. Partasarthi Das, you know him? Our Kshatriya guy? He was in the Iraq war for fighting for George Bush. He tried to get out of it every single way he could, you know. But he couldn't get out. And so in the end, Kadamba Kanada, the spiritual master, said, okay, then you gotta go ahead and just be a devotee. And he was shaved up, I think. He was like a senior company sergeant or something like that. He had like 139 guys under his protection. He should definitely write a book about the whole experience like that. But he would preach every day and sankirtan and everything else like that. So he told me one time, he said, Hanuman Swami, soldiers are not intelligent. Soldiers are brave. Like that. He said, my man, my soldiers, 139 guys, I tell them, okay guys, see that hill? Yes, sir. We're going to take it. Yes, sir. Like that. They come back with four fingers missing, everything else. We did it, sir. What's our next mission? Yeah, like that. If I tell them, they say, okay, guys, see the farmhouse and the hill? They say, yeah. First, we're going to take the farmhouse and we're going to go up the hill. They say, yes, sir. Okay. Said, if you give them three objectives, it's a guaranteed failure. Soldiers, maybe you give them two objectives, maybe. He said three, everybody knows, forget it. They're going to not understand what they're doing, everything else like that. The soldiers are not intelligent. Soldiers are brave. Okay? So that's a different dharma. Yeah? So we have to, you know, take this dharma, brahmanas and everything else, and try and develop that. But that's what's missing, really, as a head for society. And our first business in ISKCON is to try and produce brahmanas. And if you can't be a brahmana, if you're a kshatriya, okay, Mahanidhi Swami, the skinny little little sankirtan devotee, and Vijayadatta, the same size, they would go out and do books of Fisherman's Wharf and intellectually, you know, defeat people and get them to take books and whatever, and you know, they walk away happy. So one time they were down at this place called Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, and there's all these like crab places and this stuff. It's a big tourist area with different kinds of entertainment and eating places. You know? But they can sell a lot of books there. You know? So when there was about maybe five, like kind of rowdy guys, you know, sitting there smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and, you know, teasing them and, you know, yelling at people. And so finally one of them actually grabbed this Vijayadatta's book bag and was taking the whole thing and going to, like, you know, destroy him or something. And these guys were pretty big guys, you know. So then Vijayadatta was fighting with the guys and other guys came over now and started, like, you know, beating on him. And so Mahanidhi Swami, who was brahmacharya, they had to help. And so they're finally on the ground. These five guys are like having a hard time. So Mahanidhi Swami, he told me this whole thing. He said he felt himself just like going up in the air like this. Like, you know. And he said there was this guy who was like about 2 meters tall and about 2 meters across at the shoulders. Some kind of like, you know, Marine Corps, you know, special services guy. And then he also grabbed Vijayadatta and pulled him out like that, put him down. Then Mahanidhi Swami thought he'd also come to beat on them. And he said, okay, now we're going to get our heads twisted off and everything else. So the guy pulled him out and he said to the other five rough guys, he said, the Hare Krishnas are my friends. If you want to fight with them, you've got to fight with me first. So he's got, well, I don't know, I got to go home now. Like, I got to change my motorcycle. And so, he's like, no, he's okay. So they all went away. He looked at Mahanidhi Swami and Vijayadatta, you know, like that. Went on going like that. You know. It's okay, you can support Brahminical culture as much as you can. Develop, learn philosophy, like learn culture, preach, talk. You know, words are the way by which you defeat things. And then after that, you know, then okay, then you're Kshatriya, then support, you know, protect devotees, or Vaishyas, give the economic support in a good way. Use the money intelligently so that, you know, culture, art, dance, music, publications, DVDs, you know, they all go out in a society like that. So many things. So it's a very nice purport. Okay, we have it. It's a suicidal policy. If we really want to cultivate the human spirit in society, we must have first-class intelligent men to guide the society, and to develop the finer tissues of our brains, we must assimilate vitamin values from milk. Devotees, not soy, soy tofu-y, or soy milk. There's more digestible protein in potatoes than there is in soya. Yeah. Soy is a protein, but it's a very fast energy protein. It's for horses to run races like that. So it gives you all this energy and everything else like that. But then your body eliminates it. Your body doesn't keep it. You know, eliminates it like that. But in potatoes, the protein, you can build tissues and everything else like that. So soya, yeah, it's an energy source and everything else, but it's not like a wholesome energy source. You know, like Prabhupada said, it's for horses. You know, it's like a very passionate energy source. But because of our society, people, you know, like it. So we're a very passionate society now. Okay. We must assimilate vitamin values from milk. Devotees worship Lord Sri Krishna by addressing him as the well-wisher of the brahmanas and the cows. The most intelligent class of men who have perfectly attained knowledge in spiritual values are called brahmanas. No society can improve in transcendental knowledge without the guidance of such first-class men. And no brain can assimilate the subtle form of knowledge without fine brain tissues. Yeah? For such important brain tissues, we require a sufficient quantity of milk and milk preparations to create them and to maintain them. Ultimately, we need to protect the cow to derive the highest benefit from this important animal. The protection of cows is therefore not merely a religious sentiment, but a measure to secure the highest benefit for human society. Mm-hmm. And so the cows are being killed and we're taking their milk. Okay, we're taking their milk and we're using it, using their offering to try and protect them and so on like that. So we shouldn't take it excessively. You know, we shouldn't use it for sense gratification so more cows are killed for our sense gratification. Okay? But for health, prosperity, everything else like that. And of course, whatever is offered to the deities, you know, the tree, the cows, they all get benefit. In previous ages, the brahmanas were qualified. They could do horse sacrifices, cow sacrifices, human sacrifices. I can tell you, every night in Brisbane, there are people with masks going around with knives, cutting people and taking all their money. Surgeons. People are begging to have it done, right? The guy knows what he's doing. So same way, human sacrifices, cow sacrifices, the cows are standing in line to get, because right after that there's no pain, the body's finished off, and you get a celestial body. You know? But Buddha stopped it in India, in the Orient, and then Moses or somebody stopped it in the West. This was there in both traditions like that, human sacrifices and cow sacrifices. So now our pujaris are qualified to do potato sacrifices, carrot sacrifices, like that. Because we're killing. We're killing these animals, killing these plants. I saw these plants and so on. It's still reactions. But we offer it to Krishna. And Krishna accepts that. You know? So we do this sacrifice of these vegetables, fruits, and milk. And everybody benefits them like that. You know? The cow is, take my milk, you know, and so on. And save my children. And also, too, everything's under control. Right? The cows that are getting killed, you know, deserve it. Like that. Nobody's getting unfair treatment. You know? You kill cows? Okay. How do you like being on the opposite end of this? You know? And so we learn something at heart. You know, it may not show up in our head, but at heart we've slowly learning about not hurting others and not exploiting others like that, so on. So karma, everything is arranged. But Krishna allows mercy. You know, and we can be merciful by, you know, taking these people whose karma is to be killed out of the system like that, you know, and then giving them a future better position, better occupation. So any comments or any questions? Yes.
Maybe talk about this crop protection farming.
Yeah.
So, you know, the economy has really moved on. So it was primarily agrarian a couple of hundred years back.
Huh?
It was primarily agrarian a couple of hundred years back, the economy,
yeah.
with industrial revolution and, you know, the services industries and all.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not really, okay, it's important, but again, there are so many different other industries also.
Yes.
Which are then modern times, which are not their problem in the very times. So that's the reason it was probably called as most important, you know, crop production and farming.
Yeah.
But now, you know, we have moved on.
Now we're producing grains, microchips.
The needs for grains
and bowl of microchips for breakfast.
We still need grains and milk and all, but at the same time, there are so many other industries which are providing sort of employment to people, so many necessities of life. So
okay.
how relevant is it really to talk around only farming and crop production as the most important things
okay.
for communities?
The Industrial Revolution has failed. You look all over the world, what's the result? Is there any country which is economically prosperous besides Switzerland? Every single country is struggling like that. You know? So the economic model we're using is not working like that. The idea of industrialization came from Northern Europe, where the environment is not that nice. Yeah, Northern Europe, you have to fight, you know, with the environment. Actually, human beings are not meant to live there. You know, polar bears can live there, okay. Human beings are meant to live where there's coconut trees. That's a whole other thing, too, because it has to be integrated with the whole social structure like that. This big conference we had in Calcutta, the Calcutta Museum, Indian Museum in Calcutta in last May, many people came, vice chancellors and everything else, and were discussing this, how Indian classical knowledge can contribute to solving the problems in the world. And the museum was amazed at how many people came to the workshops. Yeah? But that was one point, that the Ayurveda is wonderful. You know, working the animals and everything else is wonderful. But it depends upon an agrarian situation like that. Yeah? The kind of lifestyle we have now, it's just not practical. Ayurveda requires that your grandfather, who's an Ayurvedic doctor, knows this guy's family, and he'll tell you, like, this family has this and that problem, you know. And he knows all the herbs and everything. Now the herbal sources are so expensive. Put a little gold in it, yeah. But before these things were just naturally available because people live close to the source like that. You know? And also it takes a comprehension that there is an integrated relationship with the demigods, right? And when we start doing good things on the earth reacts, and the weather changes, the climate changes, and everything becomes very harmonious. Like that. So it is, there are many things that need to be considered in terms of implementing it. So we're not suggesting, you know, just going, you know, just people have tried to do that and it's a catastrophe, you know. We're suggesting beginning to develop intelligence and intelligently, with some faith in these things, let's try it out. Okay, it works. It doesn't work because we're not understanding it properly. Okay? So yeah, it takes intelligent application like that. But if you look through, you know, not just myself, but there are many, many groups, for example, like International Friends of the Trees, big organization. What's the other one? Right here, came out of here, permaculture. Right? This movement, you know, it started in Australia, it's called permaculture. It's a gigantic international movement like that. And they have literature, they have projects, they're successful in engaging so many people. Our farm in Istanbul, we try to do some things along these lines. So Sharanagati is our farm in Canada, our rural project. And trying to develop a rural project is difficult because you're trying to go back to the country and everybody else is trying to go to the city. So it's like, you know. But they're trying to because Prabhupada's saying this and that. And this, I've never met anybody who likes living in the city. I mean, there probably are some people, but most people, everybody, the traffic, the pollution, the noise, everything else. But there are quite a few people who are doubtful and fearful about living in the country, like that and stuff. You know, I'll be bored to death. You know, it's horrible things like that. So anyway, Sharanagati, example. Let's call an example. It's many things. We've got a whole list of guaranteed failures in ISKCON now, like that, in terms of applying this. So one of these things is that it's a centralized GBC project. Okay, guaranteed failures. the GBC tells the people president who tells this and that. You know, it didn't work. It probably says proprietorship turns sand into gold. Like that. If you know, it's your sand, you can make turn into gold. And if somebody else's gold, you'll just turn it into sand. So, beginning, they bought 1,200 acres. It's called the Venables Valley. It's interesting because Captain Venables was a captain in the British Army, like that. And he retired. He got this 1,200 acre valley as his pension. It's now the Hare Krishnas have got it, you know, so somehow or other, I don't know, Indian culture. And it's about 4 hours east from Vancouver to get there. So basically, you leave after breakfast and you're there by lunch. You know, so it isn't that far. And of course, Canada, though, you know, Canada, on a normal day in the winter, it's 30 below zero, mate. You know, cold today, about 50 below zero. That's, you know, 30 below zero when you spit, it freezes in the air. Below zero, I won't tell you what freezes in the air. You know, in the morning, the radio's playing. You're going to go to work. It says, "Exposed flesh freezes in 60 seconds. Exposed flesh freezes in 50 torts." You know, they tell you how much time you got before your hand will turn to ice. So it's, you know, it's for definitely a certain kind of condemned people, you know, to live there and stuff. But some people, that's their karma, devotees. So a lot of Canadian devotees live there. You know, big guys, hot digestions, and Russians, they come over there. Okay, so they started this thing. And then it was simply organized, everything else, and you know, we couldn't do it, so the whole thing was going into catastrophe. So the ISKCON was going to sell it. So devotees formed a cooperative, you know, legally, and then bought it. You know. And for every share in the cooperative, you get 5 acres on a 99-year lease, with renewable for $1 at the end of 99 years. You know. So basically, it's your property, but really it still belongs to the cooperative. So some people have 2 shares, 3 shares, 4. So they have 5 acres, 10 acres. And half of it belongs to the cooperative, not for, you know, sale, like that. So out of 1,200 acres, it's like 600 acres, it's 400. 400 acres is not as common property. There are 2 lakes, like that, and so on. And then, okay, so everybody has their property, you know. So Dudidar Maharaj, he got an Alaskan chainsaw. These chainsaws, and then you put a bar on it, which then when you cut down a tree, a lot of trees there. Okay, a lot of, and even okay, John Baban Das, he's a German guy, used to work for Lufthansa. He got 2 horses from the same father out of 2 different mothers, they're like twins. He showed us how they follow verbal commands like that. You don't need industrialization to push the trees down. These guys can go right into the forest, you know, and take out dead trees without having just to, you know, chop everything down like that. In fact, the trees falling down, very good wood, you know. So the horses go in there, and he showed us, he said, "Let's look at their ears, you know, they're listening." He says, "Back up," and they step backwards. He said, "Back up," they step backwards. He said, "One step," he took 1 step backwards, so on. So he showed us how they're trained, you know. And he works with them there, and he pulls out these, I put the chain around, he pulls out these you know, big logs and stuff like that, you know. And then he trades with the devotees for honey and different things like that. They can live, before, I'm not sure what it is now, they were living on $250 a month, Canadian, for a family of 4. Right? How about the same here like that? That's all it required. But they were growing their own vegetables, their own fruits, you know, their trading and stuff like that. Yeah. And devotees, usually what they would do, one devotee had 5 tour buses in Eastern Canada, had a business. So they would go and then become like tour bus guys and stuff. They're devotees, they're friendly, and they go to all these parks, and they would talk about them. And of course, you can kind of squeeze Krishna and beautiful water and this and that. And it was very nice. You do that for maybe 3 years, and you have enough money to buy your land, build your house. It was 3 years of, like, you know, working for maybe about 4 months out of the year. Then after that, just basically 250 a month to maintain. And different devotees have developed different things. Jambavani has all these machines. It's like a German. Carl Jung, he's a Swiss psychologist. He said, a German, and I'm Austrian, so I can say this, a German is somebody who would invent suspenders for socks and expect you to thank him. You know, so he has all these kind of really simple industrialization, yeah, but very simple. You got the wood cut into pieces like this, and you got to cut it vertically to go in your stove. right? It's cut to the right length, and then you see, put a thing there, and you got to beat on it. So he took like a pneumatic jack from the automobile, and then welded that onto a wedge. And he had one little boy show us. The little boy was going like this, and it just goes right into the wood and splits it. You know, about how this dangerous, heavy work like that. You know, so it was industrialization, but it was all like, you know, right there with producing wood to heat my house. You know, not producing stripes for toothpaste or something. It was just like things that were right, simple things were right to the product of simple. I need warmth. I need food. Okay, I've taken care of it simply, and now I have time. And there's so many cultural programs there, different groups like that, and cultural activities like that, and so on. You know? And that's the real essence, because then you have a very happy life. And they have programs, they have time for their kids. You know? He said, very common, because you can't heat the whole house, you know, like that. So what happens, you have maybe one room this big in the house, one stove. And at the end of the morning, somebody gets up, runs over, puts some wood in the stove, and they have these stoves now with automatic dampers, with thermostats that automatically convert. You know, it's very simple, but it's very sophisticated. There's a water tank above it, so you hop back in your bed. And after about, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, the room's warm. You know, the hot water's there in the tank, and everybody does their bathing, cooking, washing the dishes. And okay, let it cool down. And everybody's kind of hanging out in the one room. The kids are playing over here with their trucks. And so Yogi Nath makes soap. He's working on making the soap. And everybody kind of hangs out in the same room, you know. And so it's like very social. The Japanese got a lot of individual houses after World War II and individual rooms. And they saw that crime increased like anything. It was very simple. The children didn't know how to feel what other people were feeling. Whereas living all together, they could just feel what other people were feeling. But our houses putting everybody in separate rooms, and everybody was like, loses his ability to interrelate. So they developed a very, very natural integration of industry. And that what they consider their biggest success, chainsaw, okay. So he then started like cutting these trees, you know, and making very simple lumber. So people are building houses, you know. And they have very beautiful houses. Any lady would go there, you know, beautiful hardwood houses and floors and everything else like that. You know, so. And they attach the greenhouse to the house, so that when you're getting your plants ready for putting in the ground, you know, because it's very short growing season, so they're already going to be like ready, you know. But it's connected to the house. So the carbon dioxide for human beings, and the plants work, so you have very fresh oxygen all summer. The bases are just full of like fresh canned tomatoes, and they won awards, national awards. Always beautiful, like, you know, fresh fruits and stuff canned, maybe like 2 years, like that. And then, he was doing this chainsaw thing and what he was trading, buying, to build the houses, okay. Then a devotee, Kalki Das, he went there and he bought an overhead, no, Duryodhana Maharaj bought one of these big things that, you know, it's slightly, a big blade.
Windmill.
Huh?
Windmill.
It's a big saw, like, you know, a big blade, like, it was just about this tall, like that, you know. And with those, it's, you know, better than the chainsaw. You can just push the wood through and it cuts it square, okay, it cuts a square piece like that, you know, trims the edges. Then Kalki, right across the next door neighbor, he bought a used overhead bandsaw. So a bandsaw is like a belt, you know, like about this thick. But it's a long belt like that, with teeth on it like that, so on. So it goes around, you know, and it can cut very fine like that, because this is the band. So this one, what it is, it's above. So what you do is you push these big squared logs through it, and it cuts off a piece of lumber like that, smooth. Then you drop it down a little bit like that. So now they're producing, you know, very first class fine milled lumber like that, and so on. And it's all within the same place like that. You know? So we're not opposed to industrialization. Right, but we used, you know, industrialization to produce nuclear weapons. kind of, hey guys, just, if you got an argument, just get out here and get a big bag of rocks for each of you, and throw the rocks back and forth or something like that. Or else, you know, so many things like the automobile industry. You know, if human beings are living in the proper place, you don't need to travel like that. All this traveling is actually quite unnecessary, really. Some people are okay, or once a year, okay. Trains. When they stop every 45 minutes, are the most efficient and most comfortable form of transportation. Yes. You know, steam power, no problem. Very effective steam locomotives and stuff. Yeah. So like that, we're saying we're not opposed to industrialization. And the Vedas, Yantravedi, the Vedas describe this, but it comes to the point where there's no satisfaction and people want more and more expensive toys and all this kind of stuff. I go to Peru and preach. To get these expensive iPods and everything else, people have to spend their lives in mines below the earth digging out iridium and all this kind of stuff. These things require extremely rare, you know, metals to do the things they do like that. And therefore the CIA has to keep everybody in Peru in the mines when they can be very happy, you know, in their forests and living a very simple life like that. You know. But it takes the government to adjust things, introduce an infrastructure of trains. The trains go back in there, they're very efficient, clean. You know. And when you get there, you have electric cars or, you know, horses around like that. You know. So that's why, you know, the fact is that these groups that have done it, like permaculture. So the permaculture process, it's all over the world, many universities, ecology people use it. It's not like, it's just a movement rather than like one group. Because one group publishes a magazine. One group organizes seminars. You could actually have them come here. And so the symposium lasts, I think, 2 weeks. They take one property, and then they use it to show, like, you know, animal protection, cows, trees, all the kind of things they deal with. And the people that, you know, of course, that sponsor it, you know, they get the benefit of having their property being, you know, directly analyzed, where other people come to see, like, you know, how they have to take it back to their property, how to use this. So the devotees, Sharanagati, they say, we'll sponsor one like that. And then that means you also have to feed all the other people that come and give them a place to put their tent or a low-class dormitory. That's part of the agreement. You know, we'll do it on yours, but you got to take care of all the other participants. And so the Skeeter Pilarski, Michael Pilarski, he's the president of the International Friends of Trees, a big ecology guy, 35 years. So he said, actually it's interesting because a lot of people, they were kind of waiting to take it on your property because they also wanted to like have this Hare Krishna experience, you know, so on. Mm-hmm. So every morning they have breakfast with everybody, you know, vegetarian, prasadam. And then they have class right before that, and about 80% of the people came to class every morning like that. And Jagadish Maharaj was talking all about this kind of verses and stuff like that. Right? So after about 5 days, Michael Pilarski said, most of these groups are like pantheistic. There's nobody, you know, very few have any kind of a mechanistic view of nature. All of the ecology groups believe there's some kind of like spirit, there's some kind of like subtlety and beauty and personality and these things like that. You know, so all of us, I guess, accept that. And he said, but before the idea was we could produce heaven on earth, you know, by properly doing nature. He said, but after 35 years in this, boy, I'm really beginning to accept that your idea is correct. We can make things here practical, but heaven is someplace else. You know, you've got to die to go there. So that was a realization like that. You know? So in that sense, there's many, the Vedas, if you look in the Vedas, there's tremendous industrialization. You know, they had batteries before Christ, right? The scriptures are how to make big batteries before Christ. They had, what's the column in Delhi? Heliodorus column. It was a gift by Alexander.
Lohostambh.
Yeah, the metallurgy involved, that thing still can't be duplicated. It's been outside in the weather for, I don't know, for 2,000 years and hasn't rusted. Yeah. So they had incredible metallurgical knowledge. The Arabs, right? The Muslims, they conquered the world with Damascus steel, which was so strong it would chop other guys' swords into pieces. What it is, it's a stress process. You take the steel, you beat it, and you fold it, and you beat it, and you fold it, and you beat it, then it builds up all these internal stress things. It makes it very strong. But to do that, you have to have an original form of steel which will support that kind of stress bending. That steel came from Gujarat. Yeah, so the Muslims were smart enough to take the Gujarati steel and go back and kill the Gujarati. This is typical Arab process like that. So, you know, the Gujarati business guy is selling it without enough, you know, intelligence not to sell these guys the steel. You know? But so there are many, many. Actually, a very good book on this is, what's the guy's name? D.N. Shukla. Two books on Vastu. They're very hard to get. But he goes to the perspective of Vastu architecture and talking about, you know, how in the Vedas and everything else that existed and so on. And this point was they had tremendous knowledge, you know, but they would just adjust it, you know, to a human scale and stuff like that, you know. And the properly with the proper sociology, where there was no overpopulation, which requires something else to take care of that. That's the essential element. The population has to be at a certain level, you know, and it's possible, quite naturally. And then they had buildings in different, you know, cities. Where do you go? Pur, a cape, gown, right? No, Pura, Sahar, gown. City, town, village. The English words come across totally naturally. Yeah, every city has so many towns, every town has so many villages. There's 90% of the population live in the village. You know? And somebody new walks into town, you say, hello, who are you? You know, it's not like anybody can be a criminal or any of that, you know, because everybody knows everybody else. You know? And it's just, you know, so again, this is the whole model that the Vedas, the Puranas, the Acharyas coming down are adjusting according to time, like a circumstance and suggestion like that, so on. So we're not opposed to industrialization. You know, we're opposed to bringing to an impractical point. But what happens? Everybody knows this. You know, in America, I've seen so many books on this and stuff, that the whole thing is a pyramid. You know, that a few people are enjoying all this stuff. You know, and everybody else at the bottom is working usually in these either psychological factories. You know, the computer program, you have to work 10 hours a day, hard work, and if you don't get the job, the product out on time, you lose your job, and, you know, tremendous, you know, pressure. Right? Or to speak of the actual factories where you got, you know, people falling into big vats of molten steel and horrible industrial accidents and so on, you know, early dying in 65. Right? So anyway, industrialization is... a few people at the top can enjoy all these expensive toys and stuff like that. You know, what's, you know, these hotels, right? They must be very expensive hotels, like Surfer's Paradise. Like that. But, I mean, you know, you got to be rich to be a surfer, right? I mean, those places aren't cheap, I imagine.
Millions.
Yeah? And how much does it cost? How much does it cost for one weekend? One of these, like, first-class, high-rise, you know, resort places. Anybody know?
Average is about $150-$200 a day.
A day? That's damn cheap. In San Francisco, the Fairmont Hotel, I mean, investigate, you know. Fairmont Hotel, which is in San Francisco, it's one of the topmost hotels. And you could argue that San Francisco is the best city in the world. Other people would argue something else, but definitely it's like, you can say it's like, anyways, okay. And right now it's probably about $700 a night, you know, for one room in the Fairmont Hotel. Yeah. I want to describe that. Was it the Hyatt Hotel?
Hyatt
Embarcadero is right near there. It's shaped like a gigantic pyramid from the outside. And so you go inside, and the bottom is big. It's like maybe like four blocks across. There's always like different levels with a Tahiti area with parrots and bars, you know, music and food from Tahiti, Mexican area, shops and everything else. It's all there. It goes up to about six stories. Okay. Now the six stories above, they have hotel rooms, right? Now of course each one is like out in front of the other one. So they're like that. So you look up and there's like these like lights and stuff. You see people sitting in their what's it called? Whatever the damn thing's called. There's a name for it. Studio. They're drinking their drink and looking down on the activity below. And you can just see like some of the Star Wars thing, little robots flying. It's totally artificial light, you know. And so these first four stories have these like extensive, you know, suites, you know. And there's even a cell phone next to your toilet. So even if you get a phone call while you're on the toilet, you can just, you know, I can't answer you right now, I'm a little busy. I'm joking. Yes. You know, there's seven, and then there's the jacuzzi in the tub and everything else, on and on like that. You know? So this is like industrialization. It allows a concentration of wealth into the hands and manipulation and enjoyment of a few people. Of course, everybody's got their own bullocks and their own cows and everything else. To hell with the price of fuel. I'll just go out and work. But once you have to pay for the fuel, then we can control you.
Even in the Vedic times, as I've heard it, for each Brahman, there were like 10 Kshatriyas and 100 Vaishyas. And so even then, in that case also, there were a lot of people who were the groundsmen. Yeah. There were only a few privileges you used to enjoy.
No, so that's what are the Brahmanas enjoying?
Not Brahmanas, just Kshatriyas.
But they're above the Kshatriyas, and they're making sure the Kshatriyas aren't enjoying excessively. It's a fact. It's a fact. And that's part of the lack of the cultivation of the human spirit. In the end, Kshatriya's lifestyle, everybody else is saying, Hari Bol, Sahab, it's like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They if you read, like, even read the President of the United States, have you ever seen pictures of, the guys entered as president when they came out? It's unbelievable. You know, 4 years looks like at least 20 years like that. You know? Truman said it's the most glorious prison on earth. Every single minute is like tied down. You have to meet these people, you got to deal with that. Now it's time for your recreation. You got 45 minutes served for recreation. Back to work. You know? So real Kshatriya and Vedic culture, and again, that's the point. It has to be the culture. Otherwise, the economics and stuff won't work. He deserves, you know, what he's getting like that and stuff. Sita was the princess, right? She had perfumed beds and best education and everything else. But when there was a little question of her character, she's the princess. She has to be above question like that. So there are many, many, you know, you get benefits, but at the same time, too, there are also very, very intense, responsibilities like that. So anyway, it's a big topic. And our point is chant Hare Krishna, take prasadam, and then, like, intuitively make your investigation. So myself, I've been, like I said, giving you like a lot of evidence from literature and things like that. So I've, been doing some in this area. But really, our point is really in the age of Kali, this Gyan approach, Kalo Nasteva, it doesn't work so well. We give some people some idea, and if they want to try it out, okay, try it out. And come see our farm. Come stay on the farm. Sharanagati has really gone up like that. Everybody has their own little way of doing things, and they've learned to live with the animals, with the bears. They got along with the bears now, like that, That's a whole process. You can walk down the road, dirt road, heading someplace, half a mile to get there. Some bears come in the opposite direction. I know those bears would protect people. Some baby was in trouble, those bears would protect them. Like that and stuff. Mother bear. We protect their cubs. Everybody knows. We're all here together. And then what they consider their greatest accomplishment, their greatest success, because they have many in terms of economic development and that kind of stuff, is that the children who grew up there, almost always what happens, it's like a classical book story. Okay, they grow up, they get their kids together, playing everything else like that. They have animals, everything else. So they understand what sex desire is. They see it in the animals. So it's very natural to deal with it and stuff because, you live with animals and stuff. And so, okay, this is my animal. Okay. So it's very natural to live together, grow up. And about 18, all the guys want to go off and, see life for themselves. My father doesn't really know what life is. It's just okay. I'm going to go off. And they go off. And actually, I saw this. It was Rathiatra. Jambaban, jumped off of his horse cart and ran over his embracingest warrior during the whole festival. Like, what's that? He said, it's his son. He's been gone for 5 years like that. So they're writing and stuff, It's very common, And after 25 years old or something, 23, you come back and you realize that actually your father knew a lot more than you thought he did. Mark Twain has the whole story. He said, I talked to my father when I was 18 years old and very seriously about what is life. I could see he didn't know much, and so I was going to go out and find out for myself. He said, I was a sailor, traveled all over the world, had so many experiences. And I came back and I met my father again and talked about life at 22 years old. And I was surprised at how much the old boy had learned in 5 years. This is natural, So then what happens? You come back and there's the girl next door has been waiting like that and stuff. And then they get married. This is exactly. Well, where are they going to stay? Are they going to stay with their parents' house? Or are they going to stay with their wife's house? Are they going to start their own house and move out? No, you live with the family. And so now they're kind of working that out, and now they're in the third generation. I saw oldest kids in the third generation were like about this big, and that was about maybe 7 years ago. So we're talking probably about 12-year-old third generation kids and 32-year-old second generation kids and 65-year-old first generation, you know? And it is. And the thing is, they've been condemned because the census cannot handle the city. Being raised up in the country, they go to the city and it's just too agitating for them. You know, it's like, you know, things happening too much. And so that, you know, they want to do it, they can't do it. You know? And other than that, they just see all this stuff and it's just useless. You know? They have so many ways to enjoy. So much of the industrialization is based upon enjoyment. How you can enjoy things. Enjoy your car, enjoy your house, enjoy your television, enjoy your airplane. You know? It's not really necessary for economic development. Just have enough food, have a warm house, like that. And so because of that, they've discovered so many ways in the country. For example, Yamal Arjun, he gets the generator going. He had no generator. Once a week, he has a Mahabharat night. He cooks popcorn. Everybody goes over once a week and watches part of the Mahabharat, has popcorn together like that. Somebody else has a sauna, you know. And so all week long, there's just more stuff than you can do. You know? And it's very, you know, very friendly, like that. So there are communities, not just us, but other communities too, like this permaculture groups, many very successful communities which have adjusted the industrialization to a point where, and it's not they're not using high-tech stuff, you know, but it's just, you know, how to use it properly in terms of cultivation of the human spirit.
Yeah.
And the books are not available. But so any other final questions here? Okay, last question.
We know that milk is contaminated.
Some milk. There's a variety. Milk from New Rwanda is not contaminated. I have cheese right here.
Yeah. We live in the Brisbane city.
Yeah.
So we can't afford organic milk.
Yeah.
But we also need some good brain substance.
Yes.
To understand the contents found in Prabhupada's books.
Best use of a bad bargain. That's the material world right up to the point of Ram Raja. Right after Ram Raja, there was still problems. Maharaj Pariksit was unfairly cursed. We're always going to have some problems. So like I say, devotees, they've done a little research, and there's different dairies, and there's different levels of DNA, and what are artificial pesticides in the milk. The cows, when they're suffering like that, their pus is going into their udders. So you're drinking cow pus, you know, it looks white. Yeah, okay. So the Clover Dairy in Northern California, they're Christian people. The cows are nicely taken care of. They're clean, they have space, everything else. And they don't like sending them off or killing them. As soon as that's worked out, where they can find some way just to retire them, there's so many farmers. This is the point. The farmers, too, don't like this. But what else can they say? Well, it's crying. Well, how else can I maintain my family? What can I do? You know? It's crying, you know. But it's a whole thing of working out the economics and stuff so the cows can be properly retired. Yeah. But right now, at least some people, at least while we got them, you know, we're going to take care of them nicely. And when they get killed, it's going to be clean and quick. Not some places it's horrible. But it's horrible in how they get killed and stuff like that. You know, other people, okay, just look that way, like that. You know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama. You know, it's, in some ways. Yeah, so it's a whole difference, you know, the level and stuff like that. Somebody said, well, you also kill plants and vegetables. That's also killing. And Prabhupada said, yes. Actually, I didn't know this argument. I was kind of waiting to hear it. And finally found Prabhupada said, yes. He said, but you eat meat, but you don't kill your children. And, well, yeah. He said, because you can figure out there's a hierarchy. You know, a child that doesn't talk can't defend himself. He's not intelligent. So he's just like an animal. But you have enough intelligence to figure out the potential and all these things like that. So same way, we have to kill plants to kill, but we understand there's a whole lot less violence. You know, when a carrot leaves his body, right? He's already intoxicated. He's already, the consciousness of a carrot is like, you know, intoxicated, half awake. So he loses his body, he's already, it's like, you know, yeah, it's like being anesthetized, being surgery and so on. So yeah, then we, you know, you should do some investigation. You can find, you know, different, and then by supporting them, then that actually does something good, you know, for the whole industry and stuff like that. The guys who do this horrible stuff realize, well, hey, these guys are getting supported by people. Mark Chatburn. for his master's thesis, he did a survey. It was enough people to be pretty reliable, you know. How much more would you pay for milk if you knew the cows were being retired rather than being killed? Like that. And I forgot what it was, but it was a considerable amount. Maybe like, if it was a dollar a liter for milk, people would pay like $1.50. That was the average person. So an ordinary person with no information about what it was, but what average people know, they would pay 50 cents more for the milk if they knew the cows weren't being killed. And that's with no propaganda, no communication. He also did another one at 20 cows. This thing normally, the number of deaths equals the number of births. 20 and the number of deaths equals the number of births. Okay. You can just say for theory purposes, half will be cows, half will be bulls. Okay. That means you got 10 cows. Okay. A cow naturally gives milk, happy cow, 1/3 of her life. Okay. That means we got 3 1/3 cows giving milk. Okay. This is the statistics, okay? The 1/3 cows. 3 1/3 cows is easily enough milk for 20 people. A happy cow, you cannot digest more than one cup of milk a day. You ever had like real milk from a happy cow? It's rich, you know, like that. And one a day is like for an adult. So basically 3 1/3 milkers is easily enough for milk for 20 families. Like that. So therefore, every family has to take responsibility for one cow. And if nothing else, they make really nice pets. But what happens is somebody takes care of more and somebody else takes care of, likes honey and somebody, you know, devotees making good money on herbs, organic herbs. I mean, good money. Once you just know what you're doing. Okay? Okay. So Papa Ki. Yeah. Mataji Ki.
Yeah.
Back home, back to Raja. Shikhan Ki.
All of this
on a mock shot, so I'll be a key. Not too much.